There are two holidays. One is Hanukkah and one is Purim. But these Hanukkah holidays are completely and totally different. Purim, holiday of Purim, talks about Haman wanted to destroy all the Jews, to wipe us off the face of the earth, man, woman, and child, tafen, ushim, b'yom, achad, to destroy us all, like Hitler, like Milajad. Not so was Hanukkah. The Greeks didn't want to do anything bad to the Jews, chas v'shalom. They only wanted to help us, to free us from this crazy superstition of believing in the Torah, to avoid these old-fashioned ideas, this primitive ideology, to have the Jews enter the modern society, be part of Greek culture, Hellenistic intellectualism. They only wanted to help us if we would only give up this old-fashioned stupid Torah. Well, we didn't accept that. There was a war. We won, and the Greeks are gone, and we are here, and the Torah is still flourishing. But the battle never ends. And in recent years, we've again seen a series of books which say the same thing. In particular, the book by Richard Dawkins, a professor, distinguished professor of evolutionary biology from the University of Oxford. The book is called The God Delusion. More than 1 million copies have been sold. And this book tells us that believing in God is an illusion and stupid, and the Bible of Genesis has this crazy mythological creation story. It's all crazy and stupid, and no educated person in the 21st century should believe such nonsense. Belief in God, belief in a Torah, is a stupid delusion. Well, I don't accept that. In fact, it is my view that the Torah and what it says in the creation narrative is not stupid. In fact, there is a remarkable agreement and harmony between the simple words of Sefer Bereshit, the first chapter, and the latest findings of science, cosmology, astronomy, geology, and so on. I've written two books on this, Fossils and Faith, in the beginning. You're in happy other languages, Hebrew, French, if you want Portuguese or Norwegian, we can fix that up too. And this morning I want to give you some examples of what do I mean when I say that there is complete harmony between Torah and science. I can't tell you all the examples in my book because I've been told I'm not supposed to speak for more than 4 hours. But let us begin. The most dramatic sentence, pasuk, in the first chapter of Sefer Bereshit is the first pasuk. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, the cosmos and the universe. The Torah tells us that the universe began through an act of creation. Creation, presumably from nothing. That's what the Torah tells us. And for many years, scientists thought something from nothing. Yeshmei'ayin is not possible. And now scientists have reconsidered. And the modern view theory of cosmology is called the Big Bang Theory. I'm sure you've all heard this term. The Big Bang Theory of cosmology is supported by a vast array of scientific evidence. It is accepted by every scientist. It is taught in every university. This theory was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. And the central theme of the Big Bang Theory is that the universe began through an act of creation. I repeat, the universe began through an act of creation. And it is interesting and instructive to quote some of the world's leading authorities on the subject of creation. We begin with Professor Paul Dirac. Paul Dirac is a Nobel Prize winner from the University of Cambridge, and one of the towering giants of 20th century physics. Professor Dirac writes, quote, "It seems certain that there was a definite time of creation." Note that Professor Dirac does not write, "It is possible there was creation, it is probable, it is likely there was creation." No! In the view of this Nobel Prize winner, it is certain that the universe began through an act of creation. We now turn to Professor Alan Guth. America's leading cosmologist, Professor Goose writes, "The instant of creation remains unexplained." We now go to Professor Joseph Silk,
another important cosmologist, University of California, Professor Silk, recently wrote a book about the Big Bang, entitled The Big Bang. He has no imagination when it comes to choosing the title for his book. The first sentence in Professor Silk's book is, quote, "The Big Bang is the modern version of scientific creation." And we finally come to Professor Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist with a capital C, the superstar of the University of Cambridge. Professor Hawking writes, quote, "The creation lies outside the scope of the known laws of physics. Today, all scientists speak about the creation of the universe and use the word creation to describe what happened. Because today, every scientist appropriate instrumentation, carry out appropriate measurements, and thereby obtain clear and unequivocal scientific proof that the universe was in fact created. The creation of the universe is no longer an article of faith." The rabbis can retire. "The creation of the universe is no longer some sort of theological hypothesis. The creation of the universe has become a scientifically established fact. Today it is impossible carry out a meaningful discussion of cosmology without the creation of the universe playing a central role." What do all these scientists want? Exactly what was created to begin the universe? What object suddenly appeared to be marked the creation of the universe? And the answer is, the scientists have discovered that the universe began with the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. Scientists call this the primeval light bulb. It has a popular name, the Big Bang, and hence the name of the theory. And that answers another question. What do we read in the Torah? We read in the Torah, on the first day of creation, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or, and God said, "Let there be light," when there was light. On the first day of creation, when there was no sun, and no stars, and no moon, and no fluorescent lights, and no matches, and no people, and no light that anybody ever heard of. And the Torah tells us, "Let there be light." And for 3,000 years, nobody knew what these words meant. And we're told it's spiritual light. It's light for the righteous and the world to come, Olam Haba. It can't be regular physical light, because there was no physical light in the first day. And now the scientists tell us, yes, there was physical light in the first day. That's exactly the way the universe began. It takes the scientists, the Goyish atheistic scientists, to teach us that the Torah means exactly what it says. Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. That is exactly how the universe began. That is, there were not two creations on the first day of creation. The creation of the universe and the creation of the light. But the creation of the universe was, the creation of the light was the creation of the universe. Exactly the way the Torah tells us. And finally, a word about the time scale. How long did all this take? All the cosmological events associated with the creation of the universe, how long did it take? A cosmological event is an event which changes the structure of the entire universe. Did it take millions of years? Tens of millions of years? Hundreds of millions of years? The Torah speaks of one day? The first day of creation. What? Cosmological events within one single day? Why, that sounds absurd. That sounds ridiculous. That sounds scientifically impossible. Well, I have here a book on the subject. This book is written by Professor Steven Weinberg. Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize winner, so we can imagine he knows what he's talking about. And the title of his book, this is the best book of modern cosmology ever written, except for my books, of course. The title of his book is The First 3 Minutes. I repeat, The First 3 Minutes. It takes Professor Weinberg 151 pages to describe a long series of cosmological events which occurred in exactly 3 minutes. A whole day for creation. Why, my dear friends, there's enough time to create the world. Enjoy. enjoy a wonderful lecture at Rishi University and have it to you with your family in the afternoon. All the cosmological events associated with creation, exactly 3 minutes. How is this possible? How is it possible for cosmological events to occur in a few moments? Nowadays, indeed, cosmological events require millions of years to occur. How could it be only a few moments? And the answer is the temperature. Nowadays, the universe is very, very cold. So everything is sluggish, it cracks along, and takes a long time for events to occur. But at its outset, the universe was extremely hot. And therefore, events occur chick-chock one after another with amazing rapidity. And when I say the universe was hot, I don't mean millions of degrees. I don't mean billions of degrees. I mean hot. And it was so hot that events which nowadays occur require millions of years. At that time, they occurred in moments and fractions of moments and fractions of seconds. 3 minutes for all the cosmological events associated with the creation of our universe. Now, before I continue, I'd like to say a few words about something else. I have now quoted half a dozen scientists. Some are Jewish, some are non-Jewish. The non-Jewish scientists never go to church. The Jewish scientists don't know what a shul is. As a matter of principle, I never quote a religious scientist. Not in my books and not in my lectures. Once he's religious, maybe he twists things or distorts things to justify his religious beliefs. Every scientist that I quote is black crazy. And therefore, that's pure science. And I'm like the shotgun. I take the words of the scientist, I take the words of the Torah, and I look for matchmaking. And my dear friends, the Shadchanis business is doing very well indeed. It is no longer the case that whenever the Torah says right, science says left, the Torah says up, science says down, the Torah says white, science says black. Nowadays there is harmony and consistency between the words of the Torah and the words of the scientist. When every scientist speaks of the creation of the universe, and the Torah is speaking of the creator of the universe, maybe they're speaking about the same thing. My message to you and to the world is that the Jew of the 21st century is not required to choose between accepting the latest theories of science or being faithful to a Torah tradition of thousands of years old. Today you can have your cake and eat it too. It is a pleasure to be a believing Jew in the 21st century. On to the second day. Second day of creation speaks about the creation of the Shemayim, the Rakia, the heavens, what a scientist would call outer space. And what do we read in the Torah? We read in the Torah about Vayavdeil Elohim Bein Hamayim Hashem Mitachat L'Rakia. And God separated between the waters below the heavens from the waters above the heavens. Waters below the heavens, I understand. Oceans, lakes, seas, the Kinneret, water from the faucet, regular water, but the ocean alone. What possible meaning could there be to the expression waters above the heavens? Has anyone ever heard of large bodies of water floating about in outer space? The idea sounds completely irrational. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to announce that the scientists have discovered the water above the heavens. They discovered that at the edge of the solar system, there are enormous quantities of water. With the ice and cold up there, much more water and ice at the edge of the solar system than there is here on Earth. What generated this discovery? This discovery was generated by the space program. For thousands of years, we stood on this planet and stared up at the sky without telescopes and with telescopes. We didn't even know what was going on up there. It was all guesswork and speculation. No longer. We now send satellites up, we take pictures, we bring them back, and for the first time in human history, we understand the structure of our solar system. And one of the great discoveries was the water above the heavens. the principal source, not the only source, but the principal source of water is the comets. The comets. So your comets was established by Professor Fred Ripple, the powerful president, who refers to a comet as a dirty snowball. A comet is essentially an enormous block of ice interspersed with interplanetary schmutz. And the numerical data relating to the comets is guaranteed to stagger the imagination. A small comet contains 1 billion tons of ice. A large comet contains hundreds of billions of tons of ice. And how many comets are there? It's a large reservoir of comets at the edge of the solar system called the Oort Reservoir, after the Dutch astronomer Johannes Oort, who discovered it. And in the Oort Reservoir, there are hundreds of billions of comets, where a typical comet contains hundreds of billions of tons of ice. Possible to bring all these comets down to Earth and to melt them, they would fill the ocean basins 1,000 times. Water above the heavens has been discovered. Other sources of water that I don't have time to tell you about, but the scientists have discovered the most common molecule in our solar system is H2O. The third day of creation. Third day of creation, the Torah tells us the following. Vayomer Elohim, Yikavu Amayim Mikachas HaShemayim El Makom Achad, V'Teyaveh HaYavashah. God said, let the waters be under the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. If you take these words literally, it's easy to get the impression the Torah was telling us. In the distant past, the whole planet was covered with water. And then suddenly, for no apparent reason, there were vast oceanic flows where the waters began to one place. I have no idea where this one place is. And the dry land appears, which sounds more like a mythological tale than anything that could be related to reality. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to announce that the scientists have discovered that exactly that one. In the distant past, the whole globe was covered with water, except for the spitzen of the highest mountains. And it remained this way for a long time. And then suddenly it began to get colder and colder. The most severe ice age which ever occurred struck this planet, the famous Permian Ice Age. And when this ice age struck the planet, huge glaciers began to form by the South Pole. And as these glaciers formed, they locked up enormous quantities of water, and the water level came lower and lower and lower, and the continents appeared. And I want to quote to you a description of this event by Professor Niles Eldridge. Niles Eldridge is one of the world's leading authorities in the history of our planet. Professor Eldridge writes the following, quote, nearly 30% of the surface today is dry land. 30% land, 70% water. But it was not always so. Professor Eldridge writes, quote, these are unusual times. That we have continents at all is unusual times. He continues, it is far more usual to find the land covered with seawater. What is now the United States and Canada once lay beneath the waves. And he continues, as the earth cooled during the Permian, this is Professor Eldridge, as the earth cooled during the Permian Ice Age, large land areas appeared as the seas receded. Almost word for word from the Torah. The Torah tells us, quote, let the waters be gathered and the dry land appear. And the scientist tells us large land areas appeared as the seas receded. And Professor Eldridge continues, in the Permian Ice Age, the center of glaciation was at the geographical South Pole. The Torah says the water went El Makom Achad to one place, the big picture, and the scientist fills in the details. Where was this Makom Achad, this one place? It was the South Pole. Now what about the North Pole? There are also glaciers on the North Pole. But there are about 20 times as many glaciers on the South Pole as the North Pole. What is the big difference between, what difference between the South Pole and the North Pole? And the answer is the following. On the South Pole, under the ice, is a continent, Antarctica. In the North Pole, under the ice, is an ocean, the Arctic Ocean. Oceans are lack of vast reservoirs of heat, therefore it can never become as cold in the North Pole as the South Pole. Therefore, most of the water sits in the South Pole. Center of glaciation is the South Pole, El Makom Ehad. That's where the water went. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you've heard of global warming, it is no joke. Temperature has already begun to rise. If these polar south, these polar ice caps in the South Pole, they've started to melt. If they continue melting, it'll be an absolute catastrophe. The Torah tells us that the earth is given to mankind as a pikadon. Take care of it, work it, watch it. And if all the ice caps in the South Pole melt, I hope all of you know how to swim. Now, the third day says something else. It is the only day of creation which discusses two unrelated events. Not only does it discuss the appearance of the dry land, it discusses the appearance of the plants. Why are these two unrelated events on the same day of creation? Is God working overtime? The answer to this question is provided by modern science. I will read to you about the plants from the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Geology, where it's written, quote, the colonization of the land by plants took place during the Permian period. Remember that word? That's when the Ice Age occurred, to have the continents appear. In earlier times, the land surface was devoid of plant life as we know it. During the Permian period, the encyclopedia says, during the Permian period, lush green plants first spread over the landscape. The Torah tells us, Tacheha Oretz Desha, let the earth bring forth green plants. Encyclopedia says, lush green plants spread over the landscape, almost word for word from the encyclopedia. Both these events occurred in the same geological period. Therefore, the Torah associated them with the same third day of creation. The fourth day I'm not going to speak about, can't do everything in a single lecture. Besides, I'm going to leave something. If you want to get my book, you should have something to read which you haven't heard of before. So we pass on to the fifth day of creation. And the fifth day of creation discusses the formation of the animal kingdom. And now that we get to the animal kingdom, everybody wants to know, what about evolution? What about Darwin's theory of evolution? What does the Torah have to say about Darwin's theory of evolution? And the fact is that the Torah does not deal with theory. The Torah presents us a factual description of the origin of the animal kingdom, a factual description which sounds completely and utterly crazy. What do we read in the Torah? Vayomer Elohim yishrutzu ha-mayim she'eretz nefesh chayah v'shortzu ha-mayim leminehem. And God said, let the waters swarm with living creatures. And the waters swarmed with all sorts of different types of living creatures. If we take these words literally, it's easy to form the impression as if the Torah is telling us, at the beginning of the animal kingdom, suddenly all the oceans and all the seas became filled with marine life in enormous quantities. Let the waters swarm. The Torah is not speaking about microscopic animals. The Torah speaks about normal, large, developed animals. That all these animals appeared at once and all different types, let me mayhem, and all this happened all at once. At the beginning of the animal kingdom, let the waters swarm. Not only is the Torah description completely the opposite of Darwin's theory, as is well known, Darwin's theory of evolution speaks about the gradual development of the animal kingdom. Nothing happens suddenly. We begin with microscopic animals, 1, 2, and 3 cells, and only gradually do they evolve and develop into large animals in the course of tens and hundreds of millions of years.
gradually. Nothing happened suddenly.
Whereas the Torah tells us about the sudden appearance of all these animals. So therefore, not only is the Torah account of the origin of the animal kingdom completely the opposite of Darwin's theory, it's also against common sense. Who could believe that this happened?
Who could believe that suddenly all the oceans and all the seas became filled with marine life in vast profusion and all different types, and all this happened suddenly?
Who can believe such a thing? Therefore, my friends, I am happy to announce that the scientists and scientists have found that exactly that's what.
To their utter amazement, the scientists who study the fossil evidence is absolutely clear. To the scientists who study the beginning of the animal kingdom, the fossil evidence shows them to their astonishment that at the origin of the animal kingdom, suddenly, all the oceans and all the seas suddenly became filled with marine creatures in vast profusion, vast amounts of all different types of advanced creatures, and all this happened suddenly. Now, there's not a scientist who doesn't write about this with complete astonishment. First of all, scientists have given this phenomena a name. The scientists refer to this as the explosion of life form. The explosion of life form. And every scientist writes with complete astonishment. One scientist writes, quote, "A tremendous explosion of marine life occurred." Another scientist writes, quote, "The period ushered in an explosion of life forms." Yet another scientist writes, quote, "The most astonishing aspect is that so many radically different types of animals appeared in such a short interval." Yet another scientist writes of, quote, "The appearance of new phyla and new classes of animals at a rate that has not been back since." In my book, I give another half a dozen quotes. "The explosion of life forms, exactly corresponding to what the Torah tells us, let the water swarm." And what is the scientific explanation? What do scientists have to say to explain this explosion of life forms? Well, this was the subject of an article recently in the Scientific American. The Scientific American is the most prestigious journal in the world for reporting advances in science in all areas to the educated layman audience. And the title that the author chose for his article was, quote, "The Puzzling Big Bang of Animal Evolution." The term Big Bang is, of course, borrowed from cosmology. Only the term Big Bang that the scientists found appropriate to describe the explosion of life forms. And the scientist writes, quote, "A remarkable burst of evolutionary creativity gave rise to all multicellular animals. Why and how this occurred remains as one of the great mysteries of biology." One of the great mysteries of biology. That is the current scientific explanation. One can ask nowadays, we will be living, it's not such a great mystery to us, because that's exactly what the Torah tells us. We should do a mind, let the water swarm, and the scientists have discovered that swarm they did. You know, I give these talks different places, and as people tell me, yeah, they speak about science, it's not about science. Say something Jewish. Okay. I want to end this talk by saying something Jewish. Now, in addition to the description of the origin of the animal kingdom, description of the development of the universe, in the first chapter of Sefer Bereshit, we have a tradition. Jewish tradition, why did God create the universe? The idea is there is a purpose to creation. The universe is not a purposeless place. The universe was created by a Kodesh Baruch Hu for a purpose. And the purpose of creation is not the stars and the planets and the rocks. The purpose of creation is the living creature, and not any living creature. The purpose of creation is not the kangaroos and the crocodiles and the cockroaches. But we are the purpose of creation. You and you and you and me,
human beings, we are the purpose of creation. Mankind is the pinnacle of creation. We are what it's all about. And there's a corollary to this. Not only is the universe created for man, but there is nothing in the universe which is not necessary for human life on earth. Everything in the universe is there because it is necessary for us to exist on earth. Really? Everything in the universe is necessary for human life? To be convinced of the absurdity of this claim, one is only to think of the stars. Our sun is an ordinary, regular star. Stars appear in clusters that are called galaxies. Our galaxy is called the Milky Way. And how many stars are there in our galaxy? There are hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy. And how many galaxies are there in the universe? This is one of the great discoveries of the 20th century. The vast size of the universe. And how many stars are there, galaxies are there in our universe? There are hundreds of billions of galaxies in our universe. Where each galaxy contains hundreds of billions of stars. The possible connection between all these untold infinite number of stars that fill the cosmos. Connection between all these stars and life on Earth, what connection could there possibly be? The idea that the distant stars have some connection with life on Earth is astrology and superstition long abandoned by all educated people. So it was thought until recently. But recent discoveries have shown that I would not be exaggerating. If I were to say that without all these stars to fill the cosmos, without all these stars, I, not another Ezra, could not exist to be standing here and speaking to you. It wouldn't matter because you couldn't exist to be sitting there and listening to me. So what is the connection between life on Earth and the distant stars? I started this lecture by telling you about the Big Bang. The universe began as a sudden ball of light. So how did we get all of that? How did all this matter, all this material? And the answer is given by Einstein's famous formula from the theory of relativity, E equals mc squared. E stands for energy, light is a form of energy, m stands for mass matter, and Einstein's formula, E equals mc squared, says, under appropriate circumstances, you can transform matter into energy. That's the source of nuclear energy. Nuclear bombs, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, nuclear power stations for generating electricity, but it also works the other way. Under appropriate circumstances, energy is automatically transformed into matter. And the energy from the Big Bang, initial ball of light, was transformed into matter, and that's where the whole matter of the universe comes from. But, the analysis of the Big Bang has largely shown that this energy to matter transformation under the conditions of the Big Bang, only produced the lightest two elements, hydrogen and helium, and that's all, a little mix of lithium, only these two elements, and that's all. But the elements of my body, the raw material of my body, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all the other chemicals in the periodic table, where did all these other chemical elements come from? They did not come through the Big Bang cosmology. So where did they come from? It was a mystery many years, until it was solved by Professor Fred Hoyle, University of Oxford astrophysicist, and he explains that the source of the other chemical elements, the raw materials in our body, is the stars. The stars are factories for producing complex elements. In the middle of the star, the temperature is so enormous, the pressure is so great, the simple elements are crunched together. Hydrogen and helium form carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the other elements which are necessary for our body. So what good does it do me that in the center of the star is the raw material for my body? I can't live in the middle of the star. What good is it? So in the middle of the star sits the raw material for our body. That's something remarkable at Earth. Occasionally, an entire star explodes. The This is called a supernova explosion. And when the entire star explodes, it spritzes the chemical elements into space, and they gather in certain areas, they condense to form planets, rocks, water, air, and the tissues of our body. And this is all explained in an important Torah source, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Astronomy. I'd like to read to you what this scientific encyclopedia says. Quote, it used to be thought that the universe has always had the composition that we observe today. But in fact, all the atoms on Earth, except hydrogen and helium, were created inside a generation of stars that evolved before the birth of the sun. The elucidation of the process by which elements were created will stand in history as one of the greatest advances of the physical sciences in the 20th century. And the article ends with a sentence that I never believed that I would read in a scientific encyclopedia. The article ends with the sentence, in truth, we are the children of the universe. We are the children of the universe. Just like a child without a mother and a father physically, there can be no child. In the same way, the whole universe is necessary for our existence. Exactly what our Torah sources have been telling us for 2,000 years now appears in a scientific encyclopedia. We are the children of the universe. These words, we are the children of the universe, do not appear in the poetry of Yehuda Halevi. These words, we are the children of the universe, do not appear in the mystic writings of Rav Kook. These words, we are the children of the universe, appear in the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Astronomy. Torah and science have become one. Thank you very much.